The United States says it's ready to lift sanctions on Iran, including those that are inconsistent with the 2015 nuclear deal. Syrian media say the country's air defenses have confronted an Israeli aggression over the southern parts of Damascus, downing a number of rockets. Also coming up, an expert tells a court in Minneapolis that the police officer accused of murdering African-American George Floyd used inappropriate deadly force. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, the United States says it is prepared to lift sanctions on Tehran to resume compliance with the Iran nuclear deal, including those that are inconsistent with the 2015 pact. The spokesman for the U.S. State Department refused to give more details on what steps Washington would take to remove the sanctions. Ned Price said the negotiations in Vienna on the nuclear deal have been, quote, businesslike. He added that a U.S. team in Vienna has held talks with Washington's European allies, as well as Russia and China. The Islamic Republic has time and again stated that Washington needs to lift all sanctions imposed on Iran before Tehran returns to full compliance with the deal.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, completed their first round of talks in the Austrian capital on Tuesday under the framework of the Joint Commission with the aim of reviving the accord. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with it. Tehran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Following the Vienna talks, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The foreign ministry spokesman also stressed that the Islamic Republic is opposed to a step-by-step return to the JCPOA.
It does not require any talks or actually step-for-step plan. We have done just one step, and this is removal of all sanctions imposed illegally against the Iranian nation.
Tehran will not accept a division of the Trump-era sanctions into JCPOA-related ones and those unrelated to the deal, stressing that all of them must be removed. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, have already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani also said the failure of such campaign pushed the Biden administration to send its delegation to Vienna. Now, Iran and JCPOA's remaining parties are preparing to continue their talks on Friday, but Tehran has made it clear that it will end the talks if found a lack of progress. While the world is desperately waiting for the outcome of the meeting, Iran says the ball is now in the U.S. court to show whether it's serious enough in its promise to salvage the JCPOA.
And political commentator Brett Yonger says Iran's insistence that the U.S. must first lift sanctions on the country has been successful.
Negotiations with the United States in such a way are a campaign of let's say who it's a contest to show who is the one that will push the hardest and will really keep to close to their principles and who will not budge from the principles that they have set out. And I think the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown that they have been quite successful in making sure that they do not get bullied into a corner, that they will not get pressured into further concessions and further injustices being accepted against their country. Not only has the maximum pressure campaign of Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo utterly failed, as we have seen already in the past few years, but also the first steps of the Biden administration, the first steps by the Democratic regime that came to power now in 2020, the first steps that they were doing have also been failing. Of course, Biden and his supporters were hoping that they could somehow still keep some of these pressure campaigns by Donald Trump in place, while at the same time pretending that they are the big peacemakers and that they are here to basically sign a new agreement with Iran.
Syria's air defense has confronted an Israeli aggression over the southern parts of the capital, Damascus, downing a number of rockets. Earlier, we were joined by our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, to get more on that story.
An official Syrian military source said in a statement that Israel carried out an attack on Syria by firing at 12:56 a.m. local time here in Syria by firing missiles. Israeli fighter just fired missiles from Lebanese airspace, targeting some positions around the Syrian capital, Damascus. According to the Syrian army source, the Syrian air defenses directly responded and destroyed most of the enemy missiles. Syrian air defenses directly fired air missiles, and they were seen in the over the capital, Damascus, and its countryside. According to the Syrian army, the Israeli attack injured four Syrian army soldiers and also led to some material damage. Now, this is definitely not the first time that this happens. Israel almost every month targets Syrian army positions, mostly in Damascus and around the Syrian capital. Also, we have news coming from Lebanese media that in southern Lebanon, residents there heard a Syrian missile from the Syrian air defenses tracking down an Israeli fighter jet over there in that area between Syria and Lebanon, in that border area. So
the United States has agreed to withdraw the remaining American forces from Iraq amid growing anti-U.S. sentiment in the Arab country. In a joint statement, American and Iraqi officials said the mission of U.S. and coalition forces have now transitioned to one focused on training and advisory tasks, adding that the timing will be established in upcoming talks. The move comes amid near-daily rocket fire on U.S. forces across Iraq. The U.S. has about 2,500 service members in Iraq. Sentiment against American forces has been high in the country, especially following the assassination of top Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani and the commander of Iraq's popular mobilization unit, Sabu Mehdi al-Muhandis. Political commentator Frank Emsbach believes the United States is leaving Iraq because it is losing more than gaining by staying there.
I don't think we can take the Iraq thing in isolation. Obviously, we've made comments about getting out of Syria. If we withdraw 2,500 troops from Iraq, I think any troops remaining in Syria, it's impossible to do that without resupplying them through Turkey at this point, which I don't think is going to happen. So it seems to me that Iraq and Syria come together here. And then today there was a very interesting announcement that the United States said that we were going to put in $200 million to one of the Palestinian aid funds, which had been blocked until this morning. And clearly the United States, I think, is going to follow through in some fashion getting out of Afghanistan. So I think what's happening internally here in the administration is an assessment. Is it worth it? Are we, as the United States, losing more than it's gaining by hanging on in Iraq? It's clear that the basis for being there, there is no basis for being there. It was a fake in the first place, and now there really is no basis. The government wants us out.
Turning to other news in the region, the Yemeni army has launched a fresh retaliatory drone strike on targets in Saudi Arabia. The Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari says a Qasif 2K drone struck the King Khalid Air Base in the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis al-Mushayyad. There is no immediate report of any damage or casualties from the attack. Yemen says the retaliatory strikes will continue as long as Riyadh carries on with its war and blockade. Saudi Arabia waged its aggression against Yemen 6 years ago. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives as a result. Political commentator Tony Gosling says Western arms companies are mainly responsible for the continuation of the war on Yemen, as they are among the major profiteers of the ongoing conflict.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, how the idea of the Saudi airstrikes is so normal, we never even hear about it on the news here in the West. And yet, as soon as something like this happens, it's considered to be an extreme act. Of course, it's not. It's actually just simply retaliation for this constant bombardment by Saudi Arabia of the Yemen, which has left, now we're talking about 100,000, according to Amnesty International, and other aid agencies have pooled their resources. They reckon 100,000 people have now died, almost, well, most of the majority of them civilians, in particularly in the epidemic of typhoid, which ripped through Yemen. And that's because the infrastructure, not military, it's the infrastructure of the country that's been being attacked, as well as the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Yemen by the Saudis. Now, the only reason that they're allowed to get away with this is because there's no coverage of it, virtually zero, here in the British press. And if there is coverage, or in the Western press generally, but I can just talk about here in Britain, when we see this conflict covered, it's considered to be inevitable somehow. And isn't it sad that so many children are starving and ill, dying, and yet there's no interest whatsoever in the causes of this? And the major cause is because it's the Western arms companies that are driving this conflict.
A Los Angeles police officer has testified on the 8th day of George Floyd's trial, saying white police former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin used lethal force during his restraint. Jody Steiger told a court session that the force against Floyd was deadly because he was in the prone position. The officer said the pressure caused by Chauvin's body weight could lead to positional asphyxia, which could result in death. Steiger said an officer is only allowed to use a level of force that is proportional to the seriousness of the crime. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. His defense team has argued that he did only what he was trained to do in his 19 years as a police officer. 46-year-old Floyd's death sparked massive protests against police brutality in the U.S. The United States says it will restart funding for the United Nations agency supporting Palestinian refugees. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the resumption of aid to UNRWA was part of an effort to repair American ties with the Palestinians that collapsed under former President Donald Trump. U.S. officials have also signaled that Washington wants to reestablish the goal of a negotiated two-state solution as a priority in U.S. policy on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. voiced disappointment and objected to the resumption of U.S. aid to Palestinians. Meanwhile, the health system in the Gaza Strip continues to struggle to provide medical service to nearly 2 million Palestinians as the world marks World Health Day. The Israeli regime has systematically undermined the enclave's health system over the past decade. And Ashraf Shannon has more in this report from the besieged of the Gaza Strip.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic. This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics.
The international community must exert maximum pressure on Israel to immediately lift the blockade on Gaza. The health system in Gaza is in dire need of supplies. Israel, as an occupying power, bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of Gazans, and it must provide them with all of their needs.
Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation.
On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Israeli politics is once again dealing with a major development as the regime's president has mandated Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to form a cabinet, albeit reluctantly. But will Netanyahu be able to form a cabinet this time around after multiple efforts failed to produce any results? And more importantly, will this make any difference in the lives of Palestinians?
The Israeli politics is back to a square one. Israel's President Reuven Rivlin has once again given Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a mandate to form a government following an inconclusive election on March 23rd. Under the Israeli law, Netanyahu will have 28 days with the possibility of a two-week extension to form a cabinet. If he fails to do that, Rivlin will pick another candidate or ask Parliament to choose one. Netanyahu, who is Israel's longest-serving prime minister, in power consecutively since 2009, now faces a tough task of breaking an unprecedented political stalemate and enlisting allies for a government coalition. He has so far failed to secure enough pledges of allegiance from smaller parties, which would be essential to forming a majority cabinet.
Well, right now it looks like he has about 59 seats and he needs 61 for a majority, so he is in a quandary. And the only choice he has is quite ironic, and that is the Ra'am party, which is an Islamist party that is composed mainly of Bedouins who live in the Negev, which has four seats, and that would give him the 61 that he needs. However, he has some far-right Judeo-fascist parties in that coalition that will not want to have anything to do with anything that has the word Arab in it. So he really has a very narrow path here.
Israel's election, held on March 23rd, its fourth in 2 years, ended with neither Netanyahu and his right-wing political party Likud nor a prospective alliance of his opponents managing to secure the majority of parliamentary seats. Many believe that the elections in Israel have now turned into a circus, with Israelis headed for a fifth election in 2 years.
Well, Israel is in a total dysfunctional state right now. As you said, if Netanyahu fails to form a government and his opposition, Yair Lapid, fails to form a government, we do go to a fifth set of elections. And it should be said that during these periods when there's no functioning government, really Israel comes almost to a standstill. And we saw, even though some people are saying that Israel did well during the COVID pandemic, it really failed in very fundamental ways, and there were at least 6,000 Israelis died from COVID because of the dysfunction of the government. So it's really an astonishing situation you have right now, and even if Netanyahu does form a government, it will be the first time that an Israeli leader will form a government who is not only under indictment for criminal corruption charges, but on trial for them.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Transforming an entrenched system of profit-driven capitalism to one of stakeholder capitalism will require more than talk. It will require the hard work of passing concrete legislation, legal reform to hold corporations accountable. So far, 2 months into Biden's presidency, that appears nowhere in sight, says Christopher Marcus, author, in an article published under the heading, Biden's push for a more noble capitalism is destined to fail. Stay tuned for more. Biden has said, it's way past time we put an end to the era of shareholder capitalism. The idea the only responsibility a corporation has is with shareholders. For such an idea is an absolute farce. They have a responsibility to their workers, their community, to their country. Biden's bold declaration to end the rule of profit above all else is part of a growing desire among Americans, and even many corporations and investors themselves, to make the business world more inclusive, fair, and sustainable, and leverage the power of the private sector for good. But transforming an entrenched system of profit-driven capitalism to one of stakeholder capitalism will require more than talk. It will require the hard work of passing concrete legislation, legal reform to hold corporations accountable. So far, 2 months into Biden's presidency, that appears nowhere in sight. What we are seeing instead is a noble, though weak, push both within the private sector and in public spheres to increase corporate reporting of environmental, social, and governance, that is, ESG performance. In other words, to encourage companies to publicly disclose how their actions are affecting the planet, employees, and the communities they serve. Many leading investors, such as Larry Fink of BlackRock, have called on companies to disclose their climate impacts. And at his confirmation heading, SEC chair nominee Gary Gensler said SEC should seek more climate risk disclosure from companies. On the surface, increased ESG reporting seems like a step forward, but in reality, it is only a half a step at best. The crux of the issue is described in Gensler's testimony. It's the investor community that gets to decide what's material. That means the standard for what's disclosed is if it affects the company's financial position. This materiality standard is problematic for a few reasons. First, it prioritizes financial shareholders as the most important constituent. This is not a stakeholder capitalism and even runs counter to the position of elite American CEOs of the Business Roundtable, who have declared that companies should deliver value to a broad set of stakeholders, including employees, communities, and the environment. A second issue is because the economic effects of E factors like carbon emissions are easier to determine than S and G factors such as board level and workforce diversity, equity and inclusion. The E part of ESG will be overemphasized. Yet from society's perspective, and if we are to take stakeholder capitalism seriously, S and G are just as important as their E counterparts. ESG reporting as currently conceived is only playing into the trend of big stakeholder talk with modest stakeholder action and will do little to correct the situation Biden discussed on the campaign trail. The fundamental issue that remains unaddressed is that there are deeper structural roadblocks to companies achieving stakeholder capitalism that need to be addressed by legal reform of corporate governance, not by ESG reporting or voluntary initiatives of companies. To meet his campaign promises, Biden's administration needs to go further in creating new legal frameworks to hold companies accountable and recognize stakeholders in the legal foundation of the company. Under current U.S. system of corporate governance, companies may choose to prioritize stakeholders, but only if it is in the interest of the shareholders. And obviously, they also may not. To effectively shift the system to a stakeholder model, they need to shift from the language of may to one of shall. That is, companies must have explicit legal responsibility to consider stakeholders, not just an option. They must choose only if it is in the long-term interest of shareholders. Such language is already present in benefit corporation legislation that has passed in 38 U.S. states and a number of international jurisdictions. Benefit corporations must explicitly state a purpose for the corporation beyond profit and have their social and environmental impacts openly assessed against a credible third-party standard. Recently, U.S. companies Amalgamated Bank and Viva Systems have taken shareholder votes, both passed with 99% support, to change into this type of company, suggesting investors are starting to see the value of stakeholder capitalism too. Biden must move beyond the current era of talk and make his statements truly actionable. For instance, Senator Elizabeth Warren's Accountable Capitalism Act, introduced in August 2018, would require all corporations with more than $1 billion in revenue to adopt corporate governance like the benefit corporation structure. The only way that they will convince businesses to do good and move away from profit maximization as a primary focus will be by holding them legally accountable to do so.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us listen to a saying from the martyr of Karbala, the Holy Prophet's younger grandson Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, about the savior of humanity. The ninth of my descendants is the Imam who will rise with the truth. God will grant life to earth through him after its death. The true faith will supersede all religions through him. His absence shall be lengthy, during which many people will go astray. Only a few will remain on the right path. They shall suffer pains. People will put pressure on them, saying, "Let us know when this promise of the return of the Mahdi is fulfilled." Those who will bear the pains and denials patiently will get the same rewards as those who accompanied the Prophet during his expeditions for jihad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Dear Muslim ladies, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, especially this program, Muslim Ladies, so welcome. In this episode of Muslim Lady, Sister Razia Shameli and Sister Zainab Barakat will talk about pregnancy. But first, we'll listen to one ayah in the Quran, chapter 39 of the Holy Quran, verse 6.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Yakhluqukum fi butuni ummahatikum khalqan min ba'di khalqin fi zulumatin thalath.
He makes you in the wombs of your mothers in stages, one after another, in three veils of darkness. Pregnancy is a critical period for women. Women need to adapt to physical changes related to pregnancy while keeping the role in the family. Poor adaptation can lead to anxiety and affect women's physical and psychological well-being as well as their family processes. One of the prominent sources to overcome major life changes is spirituality. Spirituality has been acknowledged as a source of power to guide a person in performing his or her role in any situation in life. However, despite the importance of spirituality in holistic care, this aspect remains overlooked in maternal health care, which is very body-centric.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have my friend and sister in faith, Sister Razia Shameli. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam, my beloved friend.
How do you
and
do?
Sister, alhamdulillah, I'm doing great.
Thank you so very much for being with us
thank
today.
Thank you for having me here.
Today we're going to be talking about a topic that I personally, in very simple terms, I have borderline phobia toward, all right? Mm-hmm. And not because I think that it's something abnormal or it's something negative in any form or way, but in my personal opinion, I feel that it is the hugest responsibility any living creature mm-hmm. has ever been entrusted with, and that is reproduction.
Yeah.
Right?
Especially the human species.
Especially the human species. So that's what we're going to be discussing today, and I'm going to take the stand of a person who doesn't see the necessity of such a process in life, for whatever the reason. But before we do that, explain to me, what is it about pregnancy that we actually need to discuss, because it's been talked about so much already?
Yeah, we're going to start a new series of episodes on pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
A topic which is discussed a lot in different programs and in different books.
Yep.
But at the same time, I think we're having a new perspective to this topic from the perspective of Islamic medicine.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, traditional medicine.
Okay.
So we're going to be talking about some instructions and teachings and recommendations of the religion of Islam. In this view, we're going to have the comparison between the Western perspective and the Islamic perspective on the whole idea of childbearing and pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking about how our modern lifestyle has changed our lifestyle, how modernity has changed our mm-hmm. lifestyle, and how there are specific guidelines that our forefathers used to practice in their lives that they led very much healthier lives than us. We're talking about sleeping time, we're talking about nutrition, and things like that that we have, you know, it's been changed in our lives so much. We've become night owls, mm-hmm. right? Like where a lot of young people are awake the whole throughout the night. They sleep at 3 a.m., 4 a.m.
Sometimes even after Fajr.
After Fajr, exactly. You know, I have it in my, you know, a lot of people around me. So it's becoming a norm for many people.
Yep.
Young and old. And then they sleep until noon, no breakfast. So things are changing.
They are changing.
A lot. And, you know, people not getting married. And they're waiting for a really long time to get married. And then the kind of marriages they choose. And then the process of getting pregnant, fertilization of the egg and everything. And so we're going to be dealing about these for the most part.
Wow.
We're going to have like a big holistic
discourse on it.
Discourse and discussion on this. Mm. And we're going to be introducing some points that have not been heard much about traditional instructions, and some coming from the hadith that we have from the Masumin, from the Noble Quran. What fruits, what vegetables, what lifestyle, how to purify your body from the poisons that you have prior to pregnancy, from the process of self-purification, physical purification. We're going to be providing a very detailed and practical instruction for women, young women, who are deciding to get pregnant. Yeah. So it's going to be like a practical guide for many
Inshallah,
people.
Inshallah, alhamdulillah, that actually sounds interesting. You know, it's,
I hope so.
It doesn't sound as scary as I thought it would.
Yeah.
And it's really great for, I think it's a great idea to give people practical steps. And I found it interesting how you said, like, you took it back to all the way back to our forefathers, like a good 100 years ago before the world wars and the Industrial Revolution, where people would go to sleep when it got dark outside.
Exactly.
And they would wake up before sunrise, and
exactly,
they would utilize and make the best of the time they had under the sun.
Exactly.
And this is going to be interesting. So
I think even, you know, basically we're in the program of the Muslim lady and specifically talk about pregnancy, but it can benefit everybody, men and women. Even those who are not even planning to get pregnant, but it's specifically useful for that category of people that I just said, you know, people planning to become pregnant.
Right.
And it's for men and women. It's like it's a program for both of them because
wonderful.
It entails the involvement of a parent and not just the mother. So in the first series, we're going to go through pre-pregnancy. And in the second series, we're going to go through the pregnancy. Like
okay.
What to do, why, when you do get pregnant.
Right. So when we're talking about pre-pregnancy, how far back are we going?
Actually, as I was going through my notes about pregnancy, then I reached a part where, honestly speaking, it goes even prior to marriage when you are selecting your spouse.
Uh-huh.
Because I was doing a research on how to, I'm going to have a conference in a couple of days, and my topic is what is the role of men and women in balancing family life. And then as I was going through, I'm like, yeah, so we have, like, in Islam, there is gender distinction, like we have gender roles. Specific roles assigned to men, specific roles assigned to women. There are ethical duties, there are legal duties. And then as I was going through, I realized that the start is actually it's originally on how you start your marriage, on how you select your marriage.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
If I give you all the instructions of the world, but you're with the wrong person, how is it going to be useful for you? So you have to be really, really, really careful with the process of spouse selection. And there is going to, I think this needs an entire course or an entire series of episodes on what is the proper age, what are the general instructions that men and women can use. For example, akhlaq, ethics, and religiosity are like two terms that are common among men and women, or girls and boys, when selecting a spouse. Mm. You know, how the parents should come in, get involved, how non-parents, community members should get involved. And then there are specific guidelines for ladies, for girls, of, you know, what to keep into consideration when they are choosing a husband, specific details that boys or men should consider when choosing a wife. And then there are like a series of questions that need to be considered in terms of their future, like their value system. What do they think or consider very important in their lives in terms of practicing their religion, hijab, their working. Does the woman want to work? How is the man going to participate or cooperate with helping his wife in the house? Chores. So it's like a very, you know, they say, there's an Iranian expression that says, before, prior to marriage, pay all your attention, be super, super careful and picky in whom you choose. But once you make your choice, try to ignore, try to condone a lot of the things that you see that are not exactly the way you want it. Mm-hmm. So basically, there are instructions, but I think at this point, a lot of people who are listening to us, they have made their choices. They are already married. We're assuming that, mm-hmm. and that they are ready, or they don't even know whether to have children or not. So we're going to help them to, you know, because a lot of people say that from the very beginning, when the child is born, first of all, it's going to intervene with my process of success, my education as a woman I'm talking about. Why should I bring a child when my freedom will be limited? I'm going to lose my beautiful body shape. Mm. I'm going to have like a stretchy
stretch marks. Yeah.
And I'm going to lose the original form of my body that I had prior to pregnancy.
My lean, pretty figure is going to be gone. I'm going to have stretch mark and loose skin.
Exactly.
And I'm never going to get rid of this baby weight.
Exactly.
And everything is going to sag. And I'm going to have other problems. And that whole bleeding process that happens after childbirth, it lasts so long for some people. Yeah. During pregnancy themselves, some people have such horrible morning sicknesses.
Yeah, true.
That it's like borderline deteriorating their health. Mm-hmm. I actually had a friend who had such a horrible morning sickness during her first pregnancy that she puked every morning to a point that the blood vessels in her stomach got ruptured. And I look at these things and I'm like, well, maybe the world will be fine if Zainab doesn't have a child.
Aww. Yeah, there are very extreme cases of pregnancies. I had like one of my mom's friends, she was in the same situation that you, she didn't throw up blood, but I remember she had her morning sickness until she gave birth to her child.
Yeah, so did my mom.
Yeah, but on the other side of the spectrum, we have women who have no morning sickness, just like lack of appetite.
Right.
Like I remember myself and my sister and my mom and my aunties, they had really, 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 really good pregnancies. And, you know, it's different for different people.
Absolutely.
So you know, you have to have, if you have to have a realistic picture, take into account the positive and the negative, you know, all the good and bad things, pros and cons of this picture.
Naturally. All right, so this was just a general blueprint, you know, to just to give the listeners an idea of what we're going to be tackling, the topics we're going to be touching upon, the issues that really actually maybe need to be debated, you know, because there's this idea where people think that there's this course of life, you reach a certain age, you get your degree, you get married. Okay, now that you're married, well, you have to have a child, and then your second and your third. There's even some people who are like, our marriage is a kind of rocky right now. Let's have the third child and things are going to get better. You know, and there are all these sort of mindsets. And I would very much rather if we had a proper philosophy and purpose behind the such huge life-changing and life-altering decisions that we make in our lives. And inshallah ta'ala, in further episodes of Muslim Lady, we're going to be discussing just that, so make sure to tune in. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
In mid-March, the Yemen Ansarullah movement published a number of secret documents and phone calls belonging to former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Among them, two calls between Saleh and then-director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, dating back to 2001. In these calls, Tenet is pressuring the Yemeni president to release a man involved in the bombing attacks on USS Cole in October of the year 2000, which left 17 dead and 37 injured. The shocking point is that the man is a senior member of Al-Qaeda. That's while the United States has started bloody wars in the Middle East under the pretext of fighting the very same terrorist group.
This is the most difficult decision I've ever had.
In one of the phone calls, Tenet is asked by Saleh's translator about the name of the individual in question. He says he doesn't want to give his name over the phone. Saleh asks Tenet if the FBI personnel could meet with him to discuss the matter. This is an excerpt from the leaked call.
This is my person. This is my problem. This is my issue. And I'm calling you because it's very serious with me personally. This man must be released. Major General Al-Kamish, is that his name? The PSO director, Major General Ghalib Al-Kamish. He knows all about this.
Mohammed al-Ra'is.
Ambassador, and quite frankly, I'm calling this is my responsibility. I've talked to everybody in my government. I told them that I was going to make this call. I want to work with you, but I need this man released in the next 48 hours. This is my very personal appeal to you. After 50 days, this must stop.
It turned out later that the man in question was a dual American Yemeni citizen by the name of Anwar al-Awlaki, a top leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. An enigmatic figure in the so-called War on Terror, al-Awlaki could travel freely between Western countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, as well as Yemen, even after the 9/11 attacks. In the words of the leading Persian Gulf expert Ali al-Ahmad, the fact that this organization, Al-Qaeda, which has been attacked all over the world, continues to survive 20 years on and spread, it's not by accident. It's done by security and intelligence organizations in Washington, D.C. and in Qatar, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and by Ali Abdullah Saleh. Anwar al-Awlaki was trained in a U.S.-funded military camp in Afghanistan under the supervision of Osama bin Laden to fight off the Soviets in the country. He later recruited members in the United States to fight the Russians in Chechnya. As an imam in San Diego, he was in close contact with Nawaf al-Hazmi, Khalid al-Mihdar, and Hani Hanjour, three individuals who hijacked the planes that crashed into the Pentagon on September 9, 2001. In fact, al-Awlaki was reportedly in contact with other operatives of the 9/11 attacks. In 2002, al-Awlaki left the United States for the United Kingdom, where he stayed for a few days before returning to Yemen. Whereas he has enough freedom of movement in both the US and the UK, al-Awlaki was arrested again in Yemen for taking part in an al-Qaeda plot to kidnap a US military attaché and a Shia teenager. After a while, some US officials were disturbed at the imprisonment without charge of a United States citizen and signaled that they no longer insisted on Mr. Awlaki's incarceration, and he was released, according to the New York Times. After his release, al-Awlaki launched his own website, while his online rhetoric became more extremist and supportive of attacks against the United States. Abdul Hakim Mujahid Muhammad, the perpetrator of a drive-by shooting on a U.S. military recruiting office in Arkansas, as well as Nidan Hassan, who killed 13 and injured 30 at Fort Hood, were among the terrorists that attended al-Awlaki's lectures. It is almost impossible to make a list of those arrested for terrorist attacks or attempts who had contact with al-Awlaki or were inspired by him. According to the New York Times, al-Awlaki is considered to have helped inspire the Boston Marathon bombing, the 2015 attack in San Bernardino, California, and the shooting at the Orlando Pulse nightclub. After years of being protected by U.S. security and intelligence agencies, al-Awlaki was placed in 2010 on the U.S. kill list, and a year later, the CIA finally killed its own former asset with a drone strike.
Before I begin, I want to say a few words about some important news. Earlier this morning, Anwar al-Awlaki, a leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, was killed in Yemen. The death of al-Awlaki is a major blow to al-Qaeda's most active operational affiliate. Awlaki was the leader of external operations for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In that role, he took the lead in planning and directing efforts to murder innocent Americans.
2 weeks after the killing of al-Awlaki, another drone strike ordered by Obama killed Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, Anwar's American-born 16-year-old son. 6 years later, President Trump ordered a raid that killed Nawar al-Awlaki, the 18-year-old daughter of Anwar. While the U.S. has repeatedly pounded al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen with bombs, the fact is that they are not entirely enemies. On the other hand, the Saudi coalition, which the U.S. is practically a part of, is at war with the Houthi Ansarullah movements and therefore shares a purpose in the country with al-Qaeda, expelling the Houthis from power. In 2018, the Associated Press reported that the coalition cut secret deals with al-Qaeda fighters, paying some to leave key cities and towns and letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and wads of looted cash. Hundreds more were recruited to join the coalition itself. The point is, according to Major General Abdulghadir al-Shami of the Yemeni Security and Intelligence Service, the Americans used to train their individuals in Yemen and send them abroad to carry out operations for them, and then affix the accusation to Yemen as an excuse to come under the cover of fighting those individuals. Interestingly enough, since the U.S. supported the Saudi-led coalition against Yemen, al-Qaeda terrorists are parading around Yemen city streets in U.S.-made MRAP armored vehicles. In a report by the U.S. Department of State dating back to 1998, U.S. officials made it clear that they have special interests in Yemen. This place is suitable to host some spy aircrafts, including all fighters and air bombers. And with some additions and modifications in the proposed place, it will be suitable to accept many kinds of marine ships. These include aircraft carriers and also some submarines, which are working in the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea. The presence of terrorist groups can always provide the U.S. an excuse to have a military presence in the region. In fact, groups such as al-Qaeda and Daesh could not survive without support coming from the United States and other Western countries. But these fabricated enemies would be protected as long as they served these countries' interests and helped them reach their geopolitical goals.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The Maroon Ford expedition was so heavy its wheels spun at first in the soft desert sand as it cleared a breach in the border wall. It then sped down a dirt road as Mexico disappeared in the rearview mirror. 25 people held on inside, many jammed on the floor of the vehicle, others hunched half standing between them. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Miriam Jordan and Oscar Lopez. The piece is titled, A Car Crash in the California Desert, How 13 Died Riding in One SUV. The Our own Ford Expedition was so heavy its wheels spun at first in the soft desert sand as it cleared a breach in the border wall. It then sped down a dirt road as Mexico disappeared in the rearview mirror. 25 people held on inside the vehicle.